This is Mike Pinder, co-founder of the Moody Blues. You're listening to WBAI, New York.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding its next meeting Wednesday, June 9th at 7 p.m. Interested in becoming a member of the local station board? Well, elections for the board are coming up, so come get a taste of what it might be like to serve on the WBAI local station board by attending the next meeting Wednesday, June 9th at 7 p.m. It's a Zoom access meeting. It's accessible to the public and includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and the easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website. You can also dial in from your phone. To get those call-in numbers, just go to WBAI's main webpage, WBAI.org, and we hope you can join us at the next LSB meeting, June 9th. Again, it's at 7 p.m. This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
I'm Roland Brooks. You are listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, the best radio station you'll ever hear.
This is Mike Pinder, co-founder of the Moody Blues. You're listening to WBAI, New York.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding its next meeting Wednesday, June 9th at 7 p.m. Interested in becoming a member of the local station board? Well, elections for the board are coming up, so come get a taste of what it might be like to serve on the WBAI local station board by attending the next meeting Wednesday, June 9th at 7 p.m. It's a Zoom access meeting. It's accessible to the public and includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and the easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website. You can also dial in from your phone. To get those call-in numbers, just go to WBAI's main webpage, WBAI.org, and we hope you can join us at the next LSB meeting, June 9th. Again, it's at 7 p.m. This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI.
I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's the isms, schism, game, diner, go to heaven in a Jesus name, Lord. We know and we understand, Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light. What you gonna
For my apologies to the folks expecting back of the book. It's here. I can't find it. And again, my apologies. Thank you. Let me just do this and see again.
I'm Kennedy and says, "You should be ashamed." But when they calms down, they says how much they loves WBAI. That's WBAI New York and WBAI.org. Back in the day, we had commentaries by Malcolm X, Ayn Rand, Abby Hoffman, and William F. Buckley Jr. Imagine them folks in the same room at the same time. Nowadays, we've got Bob Fass, the founder of The Feast. Amy Goodman, you know her, we got her. Michio Kaku, the smartest guy in the world. Shows that helps you not to get evicted. Top-of-the-line news and interviews. Insane artists and musicians. Well, okay, okay, we went nuts for a while back there. But now we're okay. We're like your crackhead cousin that's making good. So we know you're pulling for us. Go, go, run right now to WBAI.org and look around. See where we've gone. You can even subscribe online. Believe me, you'll be glad you did. Stay tuned.
It should be about 5 a.m. and you're listening to All. Do we want to come back live very soon? Radio WBAI New York.
No, I know we're not in Kansas.
Well, good goddamn morning. How the hell are you? This is WBAI New York. The program is back of the book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio's Pickles of the North. Good morning, my dear.
Good morning to you, my dear. And a hearty hello to our dear 19 listeners, wherever they may be.
Yes, indeed. And we're going to talk about various things. And there is a web page up on my website at glib.com, glib.com. And the web page will have a little bit more about the radio program we're doing here. So you can go up there and look at it. When you get to glib.com, you'll see a blue navigation frame in the left-hand side of your screen. At the top of it, it'll say latest back of the book program links. Click on that and you will get to the web page for this morning's radio program. And the WBAI website and the archives seem to be functioning. This is our 46th pandemic episode of Back of the Book, and it's pre-recorded. This program was recorded on Friday for airing on Saturday morning, so if things have happened between then and when you're hearing this program, we won't be talking about them on this program. A recorded program cannot be as up-to-date as a live program, but this is what we have to do in these dangerous times. And, of course, our top story is, we are holding it, 109 followers on Twitter. Hey, we're doing better than a certain bone spur on Twitter. Okay, and we want to make some programming notes here. And we'll be doing our annual LGBTQ plus infinity program, formerly known as the lesbian gay program, for Pride, the Pride March, which isn't really going to be the march again this year, which we also refer to as the Christopher Street Liberation Day March. For Christopher Street Liberation Day, which is the last Sunday in June, we'll be doing that program on Saturday, June 26th, which is the day before Christopher Street Liberation Day. And also, we are preempted for a fundraising special on July 3rd, so keep that in mind if you pay a lot of attention to when the hell we're on the air. So July 3rd, we are preempted. Also, sort of as we referred to in our cold opening there at the top of the program, we're thinking that when the station opens up again, which may be in July, but we're not sure, we're going to hold off on doing this program live for a little while, partly Well, not so much as it would have been before because we don't want to catch COVID-19 because we are thoroughly vaccinated. It's been a long enough time that we've been at our maximum immunity for months now. What we're really concerned about is getting on the wild subways at 4 o'clock on a Saturday morning, because that might be dicier than it used to be. It was always been crime in the subway and stuff happens, but you get through it. And we have noticed that there's a lot of reporting about stuff going on in the subways. And yeah, the mayor has sent more police down into the subways to get crime out of the subways and back out onto the street where it belongs. And so we are thinking, this could be something, maybe hold off a little while because of that. We have always been running into a lot of homeless people at 4 o'clock in the morning in the subway system. And that happens. One time, the entire train was taken over by homeless people. Now, usually you get some homeless people in this train, some on that one, some on the other one. This time, I guess everybody decided to get on the same train, and it happened to be the train we had to catch to get into BAI. So we go in there, and this is just chock full of people, and we go into the next one. Oh, boy, everybody's got all of their baggage in there and their shopping carts, and they're all over the place. Go into the next one, and, the olfactory senses couldn't quite take that. And then we get to the next one. Oh, this looks promising. As we set foot in there, the guy closest to the door bends over and vomits right onto the floor. We say, okay, we're not going in this one. Keep going. We ended up having to go to the front car of the train then with the motorman. And there were a couple of people in there, and anybody else who was there who wasn't homeless was in that car. And that's what we had to do. And if we had gotten there a little bit late, we would have been really screwed because we would have been having to choose between missing the train and getting into the radio program late or riding around with, people who were clearly unstable and who were problematic in various different ways. So there was that then. Now we've got slashings and knifings and shootings and shovings onto the tracks a lot. Oh, man. So, yeah, And we're not exactly formidable. We're these two little old people. And we get on there, and I'm noticing quite a number of the attacks are on elderly people. And, one look at me and I look elderly these days. So, and then I'm 5'2", which doesn't exactly impose upon most people. And so, yeah, we could end up having a problem coming in live. So we're going to let it go for a little while. I don't know when we'll show up for live programs, which are rather different from these pre-recorded programs. But at some point, I'm sure we will, and we'll see how that all works out. All right? But right now, probably not going to come in right away. We're going to keep recording these. And we must express our thanks to our saddle pal, Maxwell J. Schmid, who was so instrumental in getting our program on the air last week. Well, he's instrumental in getting it on every week because he's the engineer there when we finally post it, and he downloads it and puts it up into the servers on WBAI. And last week what happened was we got the whole thing done, and we were actually going to get the entire program uploaded a little bit earlier than usual last time. Sometimes we are a little late for Maxwell, but anyway, we're supposed to get it up there by a certain time, and, deadlines aren't always so easy to deal with. But this time, we got it, we're up there, okay, this is going to work out. It's, we're getting it up there later, earlier rather than usual, and so it's there, and I have it going, and I look away, and then I look back, and the process is over. the uploading process. Because what I do is I upload it to my website, and then Max downloads it from there. I wish management would allow us to post directly to WBAI.org, but, you know, they don't even listen to me when I talk about that. What happened was I looked, and it was not there. It wasn't uploading. What? Oh, geez. And it was, you know, something up there, and it looked like it was crashing. So I stopped all of that, and I did it again, and it went, and it crashed again. So, I better, you know, looked like it was okay. The going up to the website and all was working. So, but, you know, those are small websites, you know, just small web pages. This is a 600 megabyte file. And so I try it again, and now it's going up, and I can see that the speed is about one third of what it usually is. And not only is it one third of the speed, but the speed is getting lower about every 10 seconds. You can see it loses a little bit of speed, and it keeps doing that. And we're getting up there, and I said, okay, it's going to get up there this time. It's going to get up there this time, and it's there, and we are almost up. We have to put up 612 megabytes of audio file, and we get to 611 megabytes posted. And it's also, we've been posting at that point for 59 minutes and change. Boink. It timed out. We hit the 1 hour mark right about at the time when it was finishing. Boink, nothing. It all vaporized, which is a really bad way to do things. That's what you get when you are not paying a hell of a lot of money for your web host. Anyway, so we had to go through all sorts of things, and Max ended up staying there past his time. Didn't get paid for that time, and so he ended up staying more than an hour past quitting time, and we did finally get it up there, and he was able to post it. So that's how you heard the radio program last time. Otherwise, there would have been no Back of the Book radio program last week. So thank you, Max. It was really good of you, and we will try to not do that stuff often there. All right. So thanks again, Max. Okay. The next public WBAI local station board meeting is scheduled to be held on Wednesday, June 9th, 2021 at 7 p.m. on Zoom, even though Zoom compromises privacy and security. And according to the Johns Hopkins website, COVID-19 cases in the whole world reached 172,315,808 on Friday, and global deaths reached 3,705,200. In America, the number of cases as of Friday was 33,339,375, and the death toll in America was 596,943. So, 3,098 people have died of COVID-19 in America since our last program 1 week ago. So, by the time this program airs on Saturday morning, all of those figures we quoted will be higher, of course. And also, all of this was mostly preventable. There is currently a proposal from the World Health Organization that the world actually get together and set up a structure so that pandemics can be met head on and dealt with, and a vaccine could, you know, has the goal of having a vaccine within 100 days of discovering a pandemic happening. And of course, something like that had been in place, but the Trump administration just threw it all away because what do they care? They didn't. In any event, India continues to catch up to the United States of America, and they have a total of 28,574,350 cases at this point. Their deaths are officially 340,702. So India has had 21,807 deaths this past week. the figures for both countries are probably higher than these official tallies are. And we know that some coroners in America in red states are trying to make it seem as if the COVID-19 pandemic isn't as deadly as it really is. And we also know that sometimes things are a bit chaotic in India and, yeah, not getting necessarily the best information from that quarter. Right now, we want to get on to a piece that's in Scientific American, the May 2021 Scientific American. And the piece is titled Journey into the Americas. And it's by Jennifer Raff, who is an anthropological geneticist at the University of Kansas. And it says here she studies genomes of contemporary humans and their ancestors for insights into prehistory with a focus on the initial peopling of North America, which is what this particular piece is about. And she references something called the last glacial maximum, which occurred between 26,000 and 20,000 years ago. And that's when you had the glaciers at their thickest, at their biggest, their most expansive extent, if I could put it that way. And they were big. So 26,000 to 20,000 years ago. And the article is focusing on the models for the peopling of the Americas. And she also says, respecting and acknowledging that these models stand alongside diverse and ancient oral histories with which these may or may not be congruent. And yeah, it's one of the things you got to be sensitive because, you know, the Native American peoples, plural, of North and South America, we all know that what happened to them was what happened to pretty much everybody, but we've matured in the past, well, at least number of decades or maybe century or so, and we recognize that, gee, you know, this it's not so nice to go around conquering everybody. Not as if everybody in the world hasn't been conquering everybody else before then, because it's true. Human beings are not the nicest critters going. If we were, we probably wouldn't exist. And so human beings have been invading each other's territory and wiping each other out for, well, I guess since they were human beings. And from the evidence, this is probably something that happened before there were human beings per se. The hominins aren't all there. They're not there anymore. And they didn't all get wiped out by human beings. So you can kind of guess that maybe the hominins fought with each other too. And, you know, we want to go over where you are because you've got better water over there. So we're going to come over there and, you know, no, you can't come over here. And so everybody fights about it. And one side gets the water, the other side goes extinct. And stuff like that has been happening. So, yes, yeah, so they're acknowledging that the science and the religion of various Native Americans, yeah, they don't quite sync up. However, having said that, I go with the science. And she says, in the past few decades, genetics has also been brought to bear on this chapter of human history. And it's no exaggeration to say that insights from genome studies have revolutionized our understanding. And she's talking about people coming to the Americas because, of course, we know that human beings evolved in Africa. And human beings evolved in Africa and then spread out. And so actually evolved in a part of Africa, spread through Africa. At one point, all of the human beings who would be represented by people alive today, in other words, the ancestors of every single human being alive today, were located in a cave complex called Pinnacle Point at the very southern tip of Africa. And at most, they had about 600 people there. at most, fewer possibly, and those people are us, all of us. And so that's where humanity was. And obviously, if you have only like 600 people in one cave complex, if something really bad had happened right there, humans wouldn't exist. Just the same as all the other precursors to humans no longer exist. Anyway, so we know that there's not a really good connection between the Americas and the rest of the world. And so we know that, for instance, in other places, like we know Australia got populated, and we know that all of Africa and then Asia and then Europe got populated because people could walk there. One of the things the human body is made for is walking. We can walk. And so people walked and they kept walking. And they were hunter-gatherers. They had to go walking. And they would find stuff and eat it. That was the main thing, trying to eat. And they would walk around and they'd find new places and they'd go there. And this is what happened. But for the Americas, it was not so easy. For instance, probably at some point during one of the glacial ages, that's how Australia got populated. There have been genetic studies done, and it's been shown people coming out of Africa, going into the Middle East, and which is where humanity would have really met up with Neanderthals, because Neanderthals were right there in the Middle East. And we know from fossil evidence that humans and early modern humans and Neanderthals were living pretty much as neighbors for a very long time. Anyway, so then humans were going along. Basically, you can trace them genetically going along the southern edge of Asia. And you can trace them on out. Then they get to like Malaysia, that area there. And they go and they can populate the nearby islands. And then one way or another, they got to Australia, probably because during an ice age, the water level lowers. And they may have been able to walk over that. Or maybe they had a boat, which is, you know, a debatable thing. Did people have boats like 50,000 years ago? Hard to tell. That's one of those things that's still up in the air. A lot of these types of anthropological things are quite still up in the air. And so the Americas were very isolated because, you know, up in Siberia, it's not that populated in the first place. And there's no other way you can get to the Americas by foot. The author of the article, Ms. Raff, talks a little bit about one of the other ideas that people have had. She said, more than a millennium before the Clovis technology appeared in North America, other people had made it all the way to the southern tip of South America. And the only way anybody could really do that was to, you know, come down from the north and go down to the south, because nobody was migrating across Antarctica. We know that. And the Clovis people were one of the groups that some people thought were the first in the Americas. And she says, nah, that ain't it. They came later. And she says basically the outline of her idea is that there were ancestors in Asia. And then there was a period of isolation of the ancestors of indigenous peoples during the peak of the last glacial maximum, and that was followed by a rapid population expansion that predated the Clovis people and the Monteverde people, which is in South America, by several thousand years. And so she's talking about getting the DNA from whatever you can, and the difficulty of it, because most of the DNA you find is actually from soil microbes, because everything's buried in dirt. And so, yeah, there's that. And she says, you know, she wants to start talking about the Upper Paleolithic period. And she says, about, quote, about 36,000 years ago, a group of people living in what is now East Asia became increasingly isolated from the broader population living in that region. And then, by about 25,000 years ago, they were genetically distinguishable from the ancestors of contemporary East Asians. So this group of people, starting about 36,000 years ago, by about 25,000 years, that's 11,000 years of doing their thing in Asia, they are distinguishable from the people who are now in East Asia. So that's, you know, people in China, the Koreas, Japan, Thailand, Vietnam, all of the Malaysia, all of those places over in East Asia, these people that were up there at that time, about 25,000 years ago, they're distinct genetically from them. And she says, quote, "This isolated group of ancient East Asians contributed the majority of ancestry to the first peoples of the Americas," unquote. So it's interesting. A group got isolated, and then it happened to be in the right place at the right time, and they populated North and South America and Central America. And she says that there is a site, an archaeological site, called the Yana Rhinoceros Horn Site in northern Siberia. And people were there about 31,600 years ago. And she says the ancient North Siberians at Yana were hunter-gatherers who lived in this high-latitude area year-round. And it says this was a tough place to live. It's very, very cold. There's no sunlight, not much sunlight for a good part of the year. And it's pretty much Arctic up there. And she says at that Yana site, they got some DNA from the baby teeth of two boys. And they were probably 10 to 12 years old when they lost these baby teeth. And the genomes recovered from the teeth show that the boys were not close relatives, and they belonged to a sizable population comprising around 500 breeding individuals. So 500 breeding individuals, that's 500 people there. We're pretty close to Pinnacle Point again, you know? Of course, in the rest of the world, you've got a whole bunch more people. She notes that, quote, "Unlike Neanderthals, whose genomes indicate that they had small populations and experienced periodic local extinctions, the ancient North Siberians appear to have thrived in extremely challenging environments." So, unquote. So they were living in some stuff that the Neanderthals couldn't have handled. And she notes that a whole lot of folks in the world, including present-day West Eurasians, which is a group that encompasses Europeans, and the first peoples of the Americans, have ancestry from the ancient North Siberians, who were from, 30-odd thousand years ago. And she says, quote, "The two main branches of the first people's ancestry, the ancient East Asians and the ancient North Siberians, converged around 25,000 to 20,000 years ago and interbred," unquote. So you've got a situation where these people who had gotten isolated and were their own unique folks, they got together one way or another. And probably, well, way up north somewhere, they got together and, yeah, they interbred and they became sort of one group of people. And one of the questions is, how did they come together? It is generally thought that it was migration happening, because if you're a hunter-gatherer, you don't necessarily live in one place. You probably don't live in one place because you're going to basically eat everything around and then you'll starve to death unless you move to another place and start eating that stuff. Because, you'll either kill all the animals and eat all the plants and you got to move around or you're going to die off. So that's what would have happened. That's where you get these migrations all the time. And they're wondering, where did these two groups of people, the ancient North Siberians and the ancient East Asians, come together? And also, she notes in this article in Scientific American that the genomes of indigenous people indicate that their ancestors were isolated for several thousand years during the last glacial maximum, and basically shortly after the ancient East Asians and the ancient North Siberians got together and started interbreeding, after that they got isolated some more, and it was because of the big glacial maximum that happened in there. And during the latest glacial maximum, the question is, where were these people? Because you can't live on top of a glacier. There's no way to live on top of a glacier. And I mean, these are big glaciers. There are no glaciers like this anywhere on Earth anymore, except in Antarctica and somewhat in Greenland. Although in Greenland, it's going away pretty fast. But parts of Antarctica are going to, but Antarctica is so huge. It's an entire continent of glacier. Anyway, so there's a question. They refer to it as, what was the, quote, refugium of, unquote, of these people? Because they came together, they're intermarried, and now they're isolated by the last glacial maximum. And although they weren't living on top of a glacier, they probably weren't too far away from the glaciers, and they appear to have not been intermarrying with others. So they were isolated, and they must have been somewhere, and they figure it's somewhere from either eastern Siberia or western Alaska or Beringia, which is what they call the landform that existed during the glacial maximum, because again, when the glaciers come in, the sea level goes down because the glaciers are made out of ice. The ice comes from snow. The snow gets sucked up by the sun into the water gets sucked up out of the oceans by the sunlight, and it rains down. And when you invest a whole lot of that water into glacial ice, you have less water. So the shore levels change, and the sea levels are different. They lower. Well, so they're looking for where the hell might these people have been hanging out for, God, a long time. And that's still one of the big things. You've got this Beringia thing, which again is the landmass that only existed during a time when you had the glaciers going all over the place. And it consists of eastern Siberia, western Alaska, and what now would be the Bering Strait. And, of course, a part of the issue here is that a lot of evidence for what people were doing is under the sea. And it's been under the sea for thousands of years. So, you know, it's not going to be so easy, and it's probably impossible in most cases to dig in there and find anything interesting that would really be enlightening about this stuff. But they figure it probably is there, but nothing you can do about it now. Something on the order of 20,000 years under the water is, you know, not going to work out so well. And of course, we know that people would have been by the shore because you can catch fish there. And then you have shellfish. Now, at Pinnacle Point, one of the critical things that happened at Pinnacle Point, where all of humanity was and where all of humanity existed from about 190,000 years ago to about 123,000 years ago, the big thing there was it was in walking distance of the shore where people could pick up shellfish. Now, for a human being, hunting shellfish is real easy. Oh, I see a shellfish. I'll pick it up, smash the shell, and either just eat what's inside or cook what's inside and eat it, and I'll eat. And at Pinnacle Point, the other critical part was there were some plants in the area that they could dig up, and the roots were edible. I don't know. It looks like not a great diet at Pinnacle Point, I have to tell you. But anyway, our ancestors did survive on that not very good diet. So Ms. Raff continues in her article, or maybe it's Dr. Raff. I don't know. They're not saying in here, but I'll call her Ms. Raff, and I apologize if I'm leaving out her doctorate. Anyway, she says, quote, although we do not know exactly where the ancient North Siberians and ancient East Asians joined up, we can infer from genetics what happened next. Immediately after the two groups exchanged genes, and while they were isolated from other human groups, a whole lot of things occurred very close in time, and these gave rise to the peoples in the Americas and Siberia. She says the ancestral population split into at least two branches between about 22,000 and 18,100 years ago. Unquote. She says one branch, named the ancient Beringians, has no known living descendants. The other group, known as the ancestral Native Americans, gave rise to the first peoples south of the Laurentide and Cordillerian ice sheets. So two groups managed to merge. They were all together for the big glacial event. And then when the glacial event went away, they started moving around, and then they split into two groups. One of those groups no longer exists. And the other group is everybody who came down into North and then into South America. Here's one of the interesting things in this. Ms. Raff says, quote, more important, all genomic studies rule out the possibility that the first peoples mixed with Europeans or Africans or any other populations before 1492. This conclusion runs contrary to stories of transatlantic migration promoted by popular television series, but the totality of genetic and archaeological evidence emphatically invalidates those notions, unquote. And yes, I know you hear on BAI various things about how people came from Africa and populated the Americas. That's just some of the stuff you get, and you get it on TV shows, and, you know, things get interesting. Now, there were some Europeans we know that came over and were interfacing with people of the Americas and people in Greenland, which is really a different group of people. The Greenland stuff is, it's a different group of people who are always up in the Arctic and associated with the water. And so there's that, because the Vikings ended up going to Greenland. Vikings also went to Iceland, where there was nobody else, because that was too isolated. And they needed a certain level of oceanic technology to get there. And the Vikings had it, and the Inuit people, etc., up in the Arctic area, they didn't have the technology to get there and stay there. If any of them ever went there, they said, boy, this is a hell of a place. Glaciers and volcanoes right next to each other. Hold up your hand if you want to stay here. And everybody got back in the boat and split. Yeah. Let's go back to where the walruses are. This Iceland place stinks. So that's a different story. But anyway, we also know that the Vikings managed to come over farther, and they managed to get to the Americas at about the year 1000 or so, somewhere in there. And we know that, well, they probably did not interbreed with the Native Americans because they were busy fighting with each other. The Native Americans apparently saw the Vikings coming in as these invaders, which they would have been if they'd had enough of a chance. And the Vikings said, oh, this place is even better than Greenland, which we're telling everybody to go to, which is one of those great advertising gimmicks of history. Yes, hi, we're the Vikings. Come to fabulous Greenland, where it's wonderful all the time. Greenland, of course, is a big glacier itself. Along the edges, along the shorelines, you can have a bit of actual land. Outside of that, it's a big glacier. But the advertising, you know, they were doing it back then. They had Madison Avenue back 1,000 years ago. Come to Greenland, where you can see all the green land. And, you know, if you got there, you'd say, oh, this is not as advertised. I'm going to the Better Business Bureau about the Vikings. And anyway, who are a bunch of thugs and thieves and murderers, but we won't get into that. But anyway, so they managed to interface with Native Americans, but it was like a constant state of war. And what happened was the Vikings had superior technology because the Native Americans were at best Neolithic. And the Vikings, of course, were Iron Age, at least. And they had their ships were superior, and because they were really ocean-going vessels. They were good at that. And they were able to use iron. So if you're having a fight with a guy who has a sword that's made of wood with teeth in it or something, or a club, and you have a sword that's made out of steel, and you have a steel a shield that's rimmed with steel, generally what happens is you don't have a solid steel shield. You couldn't hold that up. So you would have a wooden shield, and it would have a rim around it of steel, and a middle of it that would have a steel, what's called a steel boss, like a little shallow dome on it, which was used mostly as a weapon. And the other guy would hit your shield and his sword would break, and you would take your steel shield, your steel sword, and you would swack away at his wooden or rattan shield, and it would cut right through. And, you know, a few whacks with that and he has no shield and you cut his head off. Anyway, so the Vikings were technologically superior, but the Native Americans outnumbered them by a hell of a lot. And so the Vikings weren't really able to do well. They could set up their colony and they could do stuff, but they were constantly fighting. And after a while, they said, this isn't worth it. Let's go somewhere else. We can invade another place. Hey, let's go back to Ireland and steal everything they have again. Nah, we stole all their stuff. The Irish don't have anything anymore. So they went looking around for somewhere else. I don't know where they went, but anyway, that was it. So there was no interbreeding before 1492. And then Columbus came over and said, hello. And so I guess there was, I guess we could say there was interbreeding there. All right. A bunch of horny Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese sailors come in, and what's going to happen? All right. And Ms. Raff then goes on and talks about the rest of the population of the Americas. And she says, quote, after the last glacial maximum, ancestral Native Americans, that's the group that's left, moved southward and split into at least three branches. The first branch to diverge is represented by a single genome from a woman who lived on the Fraser Plateau in British Columbia about 5,600 years ago. Not much else is known about this population. The other two branches encompass all the currently known genetic diversity of populations south of the ice sheets. And she says, the, quote, quote, and so she names some of the folks who are represented, and they include the Northern Native Americans branch includes Algonquins, Nadane, Salishan, and Tsimshian peoples. I don't know if I'm getting it. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. Well, you know, I'll have to live with that. And the Southern Native Americans branches include the ancestors of indigenous peoples distributed broadly throughout South America, Central America, and a lot of North America. And experts disagree over when, where, and how those populations dispersed into the continents. And that's another big issue of how did this all work out here? And she notes, you know, the pre-Clovis evidence, because Clovis doesn't show up till later on. And they have all this evidence of people in the Americas well before the Clovis technology shows up. And some of the difficulty in this is shown by, for instance, they have one place in Florida where they have discovered stone artifacts, including a broken stone knife. And it's associated with some mastodon bones from 14,450 years ago. And the thing is, it's near a watering hole, and how much of anything is there, and they're not sure You know, how significant is that? And they think maybe it's an insignificant thing because people might have not settled there. They might have been walking by and they happened to find a water hole. And one of the things I suppose ancient peoples did was they said, oh, a watering hole. Let's get some water and then go over, hide in the bushes and wait for the animals to come to get water. Then we'll kill them and eat them. And that's like a thing to do. And it doesn't mean you're going to live there. It means you're just passing by. It's sort of like a Howard Johnson's on the highway. You're walking along and say, oh, let's make this our new Howard Johnson's. We'll stop in here and eat some mastodon. And that's what they would do. That's kind of difficult to say who was there, why, and how, because there's hardly any evidence. The main thing they have are the bones and a very obviously human-made broken stone knife. And so there are all sorts of difficulties in dealing with a lot of the evidence of what happened more than 10,000 years ago in various places. Now, Ms. Raff is talking about how did they get down south? And she notes, yeah, some people say they waited a long time for the corridor to open up. There was a known corridor, ice-free corridor, that opened up between two huge glaciers in North America. And yeah, people would have easily come down that. She says she doesn't think that's how it worked, because people got down to the tip of South America within 1,000 years. And the corridor didn't open up all that early. So she is a proponent of the idea that people went along the coast. They went along the Pacific coast of North America. They probably had, you know, small boats, and they, you know, were eating here, as I said, the hunter-gatherers do. They go someplace, they eat, and then they